May it please the court, I am Scott Rose. I am of the St. Louis County Bar. I represent the petitioner, Christine Delf, in this case. Your Honors, Ms. Delf surrendered her constitutional right to a trial and all of the attendant rights to the right to a trial, including the right to confront her accuser, be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, to testify or not testify on her own behalf, and to compel the attendance of other witnesses. She surrendered all of these rights with an understanding about what sentence she would receive if she did so. And that understanding was for probation. She would be required to pay restitution, and she would not have to serve any jail time. However, when it came time to pronounce the sentence, the circuit court purported to follow the plea agreement, but sentenced her to 120 days in the county jail. This was contrary to the text of the plea agreement, to assurances that Ms. Delf received from me. Those assurances were based on the rule 24.02D. They were also based on conversations I had had with the assistant prosecuting attorney on the case, in which we had specifically discussed whether the plea agreement would include shock time, and I received an assurance that it would not. It was also based on comments by the respondent himself on the record at the plea hearing. And it was based on two prior offers from the state that my client rejected because they called for jail or prison time. The first offer called for 120 day shock, which is what she ultimately got. And the second offer called for a five-year prison sentence.
Counsel, I'll ask you the question that was asked in the prior case. There are no terms of or conditions of probation in the agreement here. So are you objecting to a laws provision? Are you objecting to an association provision? Are you objecting to a reporting provision? Or is it just the shock time?
Several responses. First, I think there are a couple of conditions. I mean, there's restitution is a condition that is specifically stated in the plea agreement and that is to be paid in full prior to the expiration of probation. So that's one that's stipulated. The other conditions of probation that Your Honor mentioned are general conditions of probation, which are promulgated by regulation and apply to all probationers. And so the general conditions of probation, of course, are not set forth in the plea agreement, but I think everyone understands that the general conditions of probation apply to all.
Well, let's say I don't understand. What are they? Where would I look to know what they are? Where would the defendant look to know where they are?
Well, the defendant should look to her attorney to know where they are. I certainly advise my clients about them. And many courts hand out the general conditions of probation at the plea or sentencing so that they're informed
of it. Was that done here?
Pardon?
Was that done here?
You know, I would have to check. I don't want to answer that based on memory. But the RISMO 217.755 gives the Board of Probation and Parole the authority to promulgate regulations related to the general conditions of probation. And the Board of Probation and Parole has done so, and they are located at 14 CSR 80-3.010. So the general conditions of probation are codified in law, and I certainly know about them and advise my clients about them and expect them to apply in all cases. So I would make a distinction between the general conditions of probation and the special conditions of probation, which are at issue here. And as for the ones that Ms. Delf objects to, she objects to the ones that came as a surprise. And the ones that came as a surprise were the 120 days of shock detention and the prohibition on working in her occupation of choice, namely the home health care industry.
What do you do with the cases that say that probation is not an aspect of the sentence?
Well, I'd have to look at the specific case. Even if it's not an aspect, I believe State v. Williams was one that the respondent cited on that. But even if it's not a part of the sentence, it can be part of the plea agreement. The sentence and the plea agreement could be two different things. And it was part of the plea agreement in this case. And it normally is. The negotiating the special conditions of probation is something that defense attorneys and prosecutors do literally all the time. And it was done in this case as well.
Is it your position not only that the court couldn't have added it at the time of sentencing, but if the court had sua sponte noticed up the modification the next day, that the court couldn't have added it then either. That the binding nature of the agreement continues at least until a violation.
Right. I think that's the answer. The court's authority at the time of the plea and sentencing, if the court is unsatisfied with the plea agreement, is to reject it. And in which case, of course, the defendant can stand trial if she chooses. As for what happens later, where the court has the authority to modify it, I would interpret that statute to mean that it's based on a development that occurred after sentencing, rather than things that are, that were related to the underlying offense.
Is your claim that the court didn't have authority to enter the order contrary to the binding plea agreement, or that her entry of the plea agreement was not voluntary and not knowingly, and she should be entitled to withdraw it?
If I understood the question correctly, I think I'm arguing both. The first, arguing that the respondent claims that he followed the plea agreement. Our contention is he did not follow the plea agreement. The substance of his actions effectively constitute a rejection of the plea agreement because it included material deviations from it. I think that was Your Honor's first point. But related to that is that action therefore renders my client's plea unintelligent because she had an expectation that's based on the record, that's based on things I've already identified in this argument. She had a reasonable expectation about what would happen, and that's not what happened. Something totally different happened. So I think that's an unintelligent, unknowing, and involuntary plea at that point. And that's the basis of the cases in Santabello v. New York and Shellett v. State from this court, is that when the defendant surrenders her constitutional rights with an understanding about what sentence she is to receive, and then she receives something entirely different, that renders the plea unintelligent, unknowing, and involuntary.
But that's with your assumption that these conditions of probation are part of the sentence.
Well, they're part of the plea agreement. I mean, that's evident from the record, from the plea agreement itself.
But probation conditions really aren't part of a sentence. Do you disagree with that?
I believe I do. They're certainly part of the judgment from the court. I mean, the reason why the conditions of probation are operable, the reason why they have any effect on the probationer, is because the court ordered it in its judgment. And in the plea agreement that's submitted in the record, Exhibit D, or I believe it was Exhibit D, the condition of restitution is right there in the plea agreement. So if we're going to parse what the definition of sentence is, I mean, it's at least part of the plea agreement, and it normally is.
Yeah. Counselor, yeah. Is your position if the trial court was just wrong in its view of the law, that it could impose special conditions of probation that weren't part of a binding plea, is the appropriate remedy then to allow your client to withdraw their plea of guilty?
Either that or to direct the respondent to follow the plea agreement. I think the respondent can either follow.
Well, it seems to me that if either party was misunderstood as to what the plea agreement was, then that the only appropriate remedy would be to put both parties back, both the court, which obviously would have rejected the plea if it thought it didn't have the authority to give shock time.
Correct, to restore the status quo ante. Right. I agree. I mean,
if it's just a misunderstanding of the laws between the parties, why wouldn't that be the appropriate remedy?
I agree that it is the appropriate remedy. The rule 24.02D is more than just a procedural rule or technicality. It's a rule that this court put in place to assure that a defendant that their constitutional rights to a trial and all the attendant constitutional rights were being honored. And this court used the phrase travesty of justice to describe a situation where a defendant expected one sentence and then received a completely different sentence. And that's what...
Does the plea bargain include that there will not be shock probation, or is it silent as regarding shock probation?
Well, the word shock doesn't appear in the plea agreement, okay? But the plea agreement states at the bottom, sorry, it was Exhibit B, Relator's Exhibit B states the parties, this is quoting from the plea agreement, the parties agree that this recommendation is being entered into pursuant to Rule 24.02D1C and agree to be bound by its rules. And so when you look at Rule 24.02D1C, that is the rule that states that the parties can agree as to what the sentence is.
That it's a binding plea agreement.
Well, there's four different types of plea agreements, three of which are binding and one is not. This specifies which type of plea agreement it is, and it's the one where the parties agree as to what the sentence is.
Well, now we're back to the question of whether the terms of probation are part of the sentence or not. So it's not the side issue, it seems to be the issue.
Well,
Because where's the authority to agree on something other than the sentence?
Well, if the judgment includes it, I mean, and that's the sentence. I mean, there's not a separate document called sentence. The document disposing of the case is a judgment, and the judgment includes those terms. And that's why the Board of Probation and Parole can require that of the probationers, because there's a judgment.
Is there a difference between the sentence and terms of probation? Or we've talked about general terms of probation being ones that normally aren't spelled out in a plea agreement, but everybody knows they're going to be part of every sentence. How do we know that? Why can't special terms also be treated in the same way as general terms? Or why is it improper to do so?
Well, number one, because there's no notice of them. I mean, we're all on notice of the general conditions of probation because they're codified in the regulations. And number two, the special conditions, certainly in this case, the two that are at issue, came as a bona fide surprise to the defendant and her attorney and even the prosecutor.
The authority to order terms of probation is given by statute to the judge. So even if case law does not determine the terms of probation are a sentence, in fact, they're part of the judgment. The trial court has, in this case, ordered them, and so whether for whatever purpose they're not designated a sentence, they are part of the court's judgment entered in response to the plea bargain.
Right. I certainly agree with that. But the statute that authorizes the trial court to determine the conditions of probation, there are several statutes that authorize the trial
court. But it says conditions of probation shall be such as the court in its discretion deems reasonably necessary. So the court, and then it says the court may order such conditions as the court believes will serve to compensate the victim, et cetera. So it anticipates that the court can order terms of probation.
Right, and the court can order 7 years in the Department of Corrections or ITC or long-term treatment or 1 year special confinement in the county jail. The court has the statutory authority to do all of these things.
Right, and it doesn't matter whether you call them a sentence or not. They are part of the court's order, which is part of the court's judgment.
Correct. And we don't contend that the court exceeded its statutory authority. The court has the statutory authority to do all these things, but the court still must follow Rule 24.02D, and that's what we contend that the court did not do. I see that my time is up.
And can you once more say why where it's silent in the plea agreement itself as to shock probation? It doesn't say shock probation shall not be part of it. Why does it have to be affirmatively stated what can be part of the sentence, or is it also what's not in there that's binding on the
Rule 24.02D1C, which is what the plea agreement was entered pursuant to, says that the parties agree to what the sentence is. Uses the word is. So that's, the plea agreement says what it is. That's it. That's the sentence.
When the trial court imposed the additional con- conditions that you say weren't part of the plea bargain. What was the state's position at that time?
During the hearing, on the record?
Mm-hmm. Did the state say, Your Honor, they were part of the terms of the plea agreement that was binding, or did the state say they weren't?
Well, it was very disappointing. The state didn't say a word on the record.
So my question is it a question of fact whether they were part of the plea bargain or not that the trial court could have found against you? Or was that not the trial court's position?
Is it a question of fact whether the trial court added terms to the plea agreement?
No. Is it a question of fact whether the binding plea agreement included an agreement for no shock probation?
It seems like it's a question of interpreting the plea agreement, which I think you would start with the four corners of the written document and what does the plea agreement say. So I don't know if I would use the word fact to describe that.
I think you said a moment ago, implicit in saying this is what the plea agreement is saying, and no other terms are part of it. So I mean, you're asking us to infer an agreement not to impose shock probation from the fact that it mentions other things that are in the agreement but doesn't mention shock probation. And would that be a factual question for the judge to decide what was intended to be included or not included?
Well, I suppose it could be if the plea agreement were unclear.
That's the point. That's what you're being asked.
Okay.
Do you think on this record that there was any question in the judge's mind as to what the parties agreed to? And it may just have been that it didn't matter.
Oh, I'm certain there was no question in the judge's
mind. I think that's the question you're being asked.
Okay. I'm certain there was no question in the judge's mind as to what the parties had agreed to, because he himself used the word surprise in the transcript of the sentencing hearing. If you look at the transcript of the sentencing hearing, which is attached as Exhibit G to the petition, page 19, line 15, this is the respondent talking. By the way, we haven't talked about any of the conditions of probation because there's another surprise. So there's two surprises. The first surprise was 120-day shock time. The second surprise, which he then went on to explain, was the prohibition on working in the home health care industry. I submit to the court that the word surprise is a word that should not appear in a plea or sentencing hearing when it's done by agreement. So to answer Your Honor's question, I have no doubt that the respondent, based on his own words, knew exactly what the parties had agreed to.
Even though he says the argument was that it's a plea pursuant to an agreement, I specifically asked the prosecutor if that meant no shock time. She confirmed that it did. Court says, I don't see anything that prohibits it on that recommendation.
Well, I could find 20 instances in the transcripts where the court is, indicating that he completely understands what the plea agreement is, and he's adding to it.
Okay. Would there be any problem for both attorneys together to contact the judge in camera and to find out, here's what our plea agreement is. Are you going to have any special or general conditions of probation? Is there anything unethical or appropriate about that?
No, and I requested such a conference before the sentencing hearing, and Judge Wilkins would not see us beforehand.
He what? I'm sorry.
I requested the very meeting that this judge just asked me about. I requested that there be an in-camera meeting with Judge Wilkins and the prosecutor, because if he was considering rejecting the plea agreement, I wanted to talk about it. I wanted to make arguments about it, and this stuff would have been flushed out in that meeting. I requested that meeting, and he would not see us. He wanted to do it on the record. I think I'm way over time.
Thank you.
Correct.
May it please the court?
Mm-hmm.
The question before this court is whether respondent abused his discretion in adding conditions of probation. And this issue is obviously before this court because Relator is dissatisfied with the conditions of her probation.
I think the first issue is, did the state enter into a binding plea agreement with the defendant that there would not be shock probation? And as an officer of the court, what's the state's position?
Yes and no. There was a binding plea agreement for a specific sentence. Conditions of probation were not part of the plea agreement. They weren't negotiated. In Jefferson County, the custom in felony cases is not to include conditions of probation in plea agreements. It's kind of impractical to include conditions of probation in a plea agreement. It's kind of impossible because we don't really know what conditions should...
If I remember correctly, there was an earlier discussion, shock probation was going to be part of the offer, what the prosecutor wanted, and the defense rejected that, and it was not included in the final plea agreement. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I think I have...
So the question is, was that intended to be included in the plea agreement, or was shock probation not supposed to be a part of it?
I have to clarify what shock probation means, because it can mean a lot of different things. Shock is a really general term. It could mean shock incarceration pursuant to Chapter 559.115, in which case the court would be executing a sentence to serve and then retaining jurisdiction to grant probation for a period of 120 days. Shock incarceration could mean a court-ordered detention sanction pursuant to 559.036. In this case, Chapter 559.026 specifically authorizes courts to order detention as a condition of probation.
The record says, Mr. Rose's statement is, I specifically asked the prosecutor if that meant no shock time, and she confirmed that it did.
I really have to disagree with his portrayal of that conversation. It was a very fleeting conversation at the end of a deposition.
Is that in the record below?
The
state's position that they disagreed with that?
That I disagree with the portrayal? I denied it in the petition because the plea agreement was reduced to writing. And so here's the conversation that happened. We're leaving depots. After things that came out in depositions, I extended the 7-year suspended execution of sentence recommendation. I don't have a great recollection of this conversation because it was so fleeting. And Mr. Rose had asked, does that mean no shock? And I said, yeah, no shock. In my mind at that time, my first recommendation was for 7 years pursuant to 559.115. That's what I understood shock to mean. But the bottom line, I don't think it matters here what that conversation was, because the plea agreement was reduced to writing. There's a local rule in Jefferson County, 67.8. It's a local Jefferson County rule that plea agreements must be reduced to writing and that those written agreements must be submitted to the court. And so the written agreement, a 7 SES, I went back to my office after that deposition. I typed up the written plea agreement. I sent it to Mr. Rose. He signed it. His client signed it without modification, and they submitted it to the court. And Rule 2402 is for a specific sentence, okay? The bargain for sentence in this case was a 7-year suspended sentence. That is precisely the sentence that relator received. Conditions of probation are not part of a sentence.
Was it reasonable for the defendant to believe that she was pleading guilty under a binding plea agreement to no jail time?
I don't think that question is before this court.
Well, it is. The question was before the trial court. One, did he have a binding plea agreement that he was compelled to follow? Or two, was the plea not voluntary or knowing because there was a misrepresentation as to what it was?
So I think the plea agreement was for a binding sentence. I think the sentence was the SES. I think the conditions of probation were left to the court. And as far as voluntariness goes, I mean, the ruling that's before this court that relator is challenging is the motion that Judge Wilkins denied. All it said was that it was pursuant to Rule 24.02, that it was to either enforce the plea agreement or let her withdraw her guilty plea. Rule 2907 isn't mentioned. Voluntariness isn't mentioned in that motion. Manifest injustice isn't mentioned in that motion. I'm not saying that relator might have those arguments. I'm not saying that her plea might have been involuntary. It may have or it may not have, but we haven't had an evidentiary hearing, and there's more to that question. McNeil sets out the test, and this is important. Is there a reasonable basis in the record? Okay, we don't have a record. There's more questions we need to know. We need to know is, would further advice of counsel as to conditions of probation change relator's decision to plead guilty? Okay, after depositions, there was the possibility, more information came out, that I might have filed enhanced charges. I need to know, would her decision to plead guilty have changed knowing she might face 15 years imprisonment? Would she risk 15 years imprisonment at trial to avoid 120 days? Awareness of certain facts doesn't render a plea involuntary. It's the defendant's burden to show that the court erred. And I kind of think this is akin to collateral consequences of a plea. There are only certain things that a defendant needs to know going into pleading guilty. They need to know the nature of the charge. They need to know the maximum and mandatory minimum penalties, that they have a right to an attorney, that they have a right not to plead guilty, and that they're waiving all trial rights. That's pursuant to 2402B. It's kind of impractical. I think that knowing all conditions of probation going into a plea, it's akin to collateral consequences. And, you know, so the remainder of that test under McNeil is there a reasonable basis in the record for the mistaken belief as to the plea bargain based on positive representations the defendant is entitled to rely? So does she have to know that this is a condition of probation going into the plea? It's not one of those five things listed in 2402. And
is it appropriate to have conditions of probation as part of a plea agreement?
I don't think so.
So you could not negotiate over whether someone would get shock probation, though that was one of your offers, if you're saying all they are is conditions of probation.
Okay. Let me shock pursuant to 559.026, detention in the county jail. Or
you're saying that that's an inappropriate subject for a plea agreement?
It's not inappropriate. It could be included, but the point is that conditions of probation weren't negotiated in this case. And so conditions of probation are left to the court, and I think it's really bad policy to
say. Well, it does sound like this one was negotiated.
559.115 was negotiated.
Shock probation.
In prison. Shock. And I guess maybe there's a different.
Let me ask this. If you had agreed with counsel to a binding plea agreement under 559.115, what would that written plea agreement say?
That written plea agreement would say, yes, the term of years, so 7 years to serve. The state has no objection to sentencing pursuant to 559.115 if approved by the Department of Corrections and the court. That would be a to-serve recommendation, allowing the court to retain jurisdiction to grant probation up to, by the statute, 120 days.
But that is part of the sentence, is that you go in under 115, that they're placed there by corrections, and that the sentence is subject to suspension and probation for 120 days.
Well, I think that's the distinction. I think 559.115 is part of a sentence. I think 559.026 is a condition of probation. That was
what I was trying to ask.
Okay. I mean, that's specifically what the statute says. 559.026 specifically says detention as a condition of probation. And the law is really clear that conditions of probation are left to the discretion of the court. I think it sets bad policy that probationers can pick and choose the conditions of their probation. Probation's not supposed to be easy. It's not a right. It's a privilege.
Is there any law that says that plea bargain can include terms of probation?
I don't think there's any law that says it either way.
Are there cases where terms of probation have been the basis for setting aside a plea because of not following the plea agreement or because they were not knowingly or intelligently made?
There is very minimal case law with respect to conditions of probation. All of the cases cited by relator have to do with somebody that's actually in prison on a sentence. None of them have to do with conditions of probation. The only case that I'm aware of that has to do with a condition of probation was a 2008 case before this court on a writ of prohibition that had to do with a condition of probation. That was Doe v. Moore. In that case, the defendant pled guilty to endangering the welfare of a child, and as a condition of probation, the circuit court said, you're going to be supervised as a sex offender. And in considering considering whether the trial court abused its discretion, this court looked at, what did the circuit court look at when it decided to add that condition of probation? And in that case, they looked at the underlying offense, the facts of it, and they looked at the recommendation of the probation officer. And because of those things, they found no abuse of discretion. And that's...
But it was not a case that dealt with whether or not it was part of a binding plea agreement.
No, I am aware of no case that has to do with a condition of probation as part of a binding plea agreement. And I think that's because 2402 says a sentence, and then, probation, State v. Williams, probation and its terms are not part of a sentence. They're left to the court. They're left to the discretion of the court. The remedy here is if the relator is dissatisfied with the conditions of her probation, this is State v. Federhoff, her remedy is to accept the sentence. She has some other remedies if her plea was involuntary because of what counsel told her or because of what she understood.
The most commonly negotiated term of probation between the state and the defendant is usually restitution, isn't it?
I think that's pretty common. But I think restitution is kind of its own thing because it can be a condition of probation.
It's a term of probation, though, isn't it?
Well, it can be ordered if someone's sent to prison too, pursuant to 559, 100, and 105. So I kind of think probation's its own thing.
Restitution.
I apologize.
They're the agreements to the amount, which is a fact that's usually divorced the charge and the maybe even the probable cause thing.
I personally don't take the position that I have a whole lot of leeway in negotiating a restitution figure because I don't want to put myself in the position of negotiating some sort of civil settlement. So if the victim says this is what I'm owed, that's sort of how I take it. And if the defense wants to dispute it, then we can have a restitution hearing before the court. But I don't really like to negotiate that. I don't like to put myself in that situation. I think the bottom line here is that the question is whether Judge Wilkins abused his discretion here, and I think the answer is that he didn't. The facts of the underlying case are that relator, she forged a check on the victim's account. She didn't have permission to do so. It was a $5,000 check. And when Judge Wilkins read her sentencing assessment report, he was outraged. She'd done this before in St. Louis County. It was 9 counts. It was $25,000 while she was on probation. It was alleged that she'd done it again. And so he had good reason to impose these conditions of probation. He's got to consider, how do I rehabilitate this offender and make sure she doesn't do this again? But I've also got to think about the public here and protect the public. And he's authorized by statute to add conditions of probation. Chapter 559.026 specifically authorizes detention as a condition of probation, and I think those things considered, Judge Wilkins didn't abuse his discretion in this case. But again, I think for the court to rule in this case that detention as it can't be a condition of probation would be contrary to the statute, to the regulations. It would set bad policy. So now, not just immediately after sentencing, but sometime down the road, we're going down this slippery slope of a probationer decides, I don't like this condition of probation. This is difficult. I wouldn't have pled guilty if I would have known that would have been a condition of probation. And then we've opened the floodgates to post-conviction claims. And so I think that in this case, there was a binding plea agreement. I think the court followed the plea agreement and that relator got the sentence for which she bargained. It's in the record. There's nothing else that was said additional in the plea. And Judge Wilkins specifically said multiple times in the recommendation, I am not rejecting the recommendation. I see my time is up.
Thank you.
I think my time is already up. So
you have 3 minutes.
Oh, I have 3 minutes anyway? Okay.
You do? You were answering questions.
All right. Well, the issue about what was discussed regarding shock time was mentioned on the record at the sentencing. On page 16 of the sentencing transcript, I said, quote, "I will say that if shock time is one of the conditions, that was specifically discussed. The first question I asked Ms. Robertson when this possible plea arrangement came up was, does that mean no shock time? And she confirmed it does mean no shock time." Those were my comments on the record. Ms. Robertson was there. She didn't disagree with them.
So that might make it clear that the parties thought that that was the agreement, and that the legal issue really is whether or not this court, when it accepted the plea and added the special conditions, violated the binding nature of the plea. And it seems like we're all pretty well focused on whether or not it's a collateral consequence or whether or not it's part of the sentence, and what the rules in the statute would say relative to that.
Well, and I believe another judge pointed out that we were negotiating it essentially all the way through the case. I
mean, assume that the circuit court decided that, at least assume that the circuit court thought the deal was the deal was that the lawyers couldn't tell the judge whether or not the judge could add the condition of probation under 559.026 of some type of detention. Assume the court said your agreement is binding, but it doesn't prohibit this action. I mean, isn't that really what this case is about?
Well, I think so. I mean, the court can just reject it at that point.
But the court didn't think it had to reject the plea. The court read the rule and said, assume for sake of argument, that the court read the rule, says the sentence means the sentence, and in my view, or at least my interpretation of the law, is this is not part of the sentence.
Right. So,
in other words, not that nobody was being cute. It's just that you had a disagreement as to what the law required in this case.
Well, then the three parties, the state, the defendant, and the sentencing court, are not on the same page about the meaning of the plea agreement. And so I don't think there's been a meeting of the minds, and it has to be withdrawn at that point.
So you're saying that a reason to reject the plea agreement might be that it covers things that it's not allowed to cover, but it's still a rejection of it, and you should have been able to withdraw your plea.
Correct. I mean, if the defendant has reasonable expectations based on things that appear in the record, I think that was the test in Reed v. State, and those expectations are not met, then the defendant has to be afforded an opportunity to withdraw the plea.
I certainly understand the argument. How does that square with our case decisions regarding minimum time requirements, like the 85% rule, where we said that wasn't part of the plea agreement? In other words, that didn't violate the defendant's right of a knowing and involuntary plea. In other words, there was a case that dealt with whether or not the defendant would be required to serve 85% of the sentence. It was clear on the record that the defendant didn't think that that was part of the plea agreement. That was just wrong. So, but it was considered a collateral consequence.
The defendant wasn't told as part of the plea that it would, he would have to serve 85% of the sentence, and said that would be a reason to get a withdraw the plea, and the court said that was a collateral consequence and you're not entitled to be informed.
Well, that would be ineffective assistance of counsel. If the defendant's attorney allowed his client to plead guilty to an offense that requires him to serve 85% of his time and did not inform his client of that,
that wouldn't affect the binding nature of the plea, or would that affect the binding nature of the plea?
Well, I think it would affect the binding nature of the plea, but you go down the road through the ineffective assistance of counsel cases that there was, you know, that's ineffective assistance, there was prejudice from it, the defendant would have done something different had he been properly informed. I mean, the defense attorney has an obligation, even as a collateral consequence, the defense attorney still has to properly inform.
And if our cases say you don't have to tell them about collateral consequences, would that affect this case? This is not a collateral consequence case. You're saying this is part of the sentence.
I don't think this is a collateral consequence case, but there was just that, and I'm not going to remember the name off the top of my head, but there was just a year ago the collateral consequence case from the U.S. Supreme Court about immigration status.
We've had our case after Padilla dealing with the 85% rule. That's the case I was asking you about.
Okay.
Maybe you're not familiar with it.
Yeah, I mean, I could...
I'm not meaning to try you up. I'm just trying to give you an opportunity to respond to...
I can certainly submit a supplemental brief on that after reviewing that. It seems to me that it would be ineffective assistance of counsel not to.
But that's not this case. If this court has already addressed that and said that Padilla is limited to immigration cases, that wouldn't affect this case.
I wouldn't think so. I've never argued ineffective assistance of counsel in this case, and it's not one of the points relied on.
Thank you. Case will be submitted. Court.